89.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, May 30th, 2010, here in WILL AM 580 on this gorgeous Memorial Day holiday weekend. Today we're going to be talking about an issue closely related to media, first cousins, if not brother or sister to media, education and teaching, where it stands in our society, what good education is, and what the barriers are to having it. Our guest will be none other than Bill Ayers, a noted educator, author of many books, including the brand new book, Comic Book, to teach the journey in comics. It'll be a great hour. Sit back, relax, and enjoy us. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
A one-year effort to reinvent journalism's role in the nation's underserved communities will begin in Detroit on June 3rd at an event called Journalism That Matters, Create or Die, Innovate, Incubate, Initiate. Michelle Ferrier is the event's chief organizer. She's been involved with previous Journalism That Matters events held around the country and recognized a need to diversify the conversation.
I found that each one of them that I was one of the few handful of people there that were of color. And I said, you know, we need to increase the visibility and participation of people of color and diverse audiences because there really wasn't that representation in the room.
Journalism That Matters gatherings are billed as unconferences because they work with the principles of open space technologies, which have no hierarchy or agenda. The participants create the conference as it happens.
That technology is something that works really well in terms of really bringing the knowledge of a room to bear in a conference. Normally, a conference is about experts and panels talking at people, and the open space technology works really well to have the participants really be the center of the knowledge base for the conference. And I think that type of generative space is exactly where we need to be to create the journalism innovations of the future.
For Ferrier, who has a journalism and community activist background, the goal of the event is to use journalism to build strong communities.
What we're trying to do is to take the seemingly monolithic media space and give people the tools and give people the technologies and the talents to be able to, one, see that that space isn't monolithic, two, find a space for themselves, three, give them the tools to be able to grow something there so that their voices can be heard.
For more information on the Journalism That Matters conference, go to journalismthatmatters.org.
Last week, the Federal Communications Commission held a day-long workshop on media ownership at Stanford University to discuss the impact of new media on broadcast stations. The commission appeared to be seeking an answer to a basic question: do media ownership rules still matter? And during the public comment period, panelist after panelist approached the microphone to deliver a resounding yes. Oriana Saportas, an Oakland resident and public access producer, reminded the FCC that they needed to serve as the voice of the people in Washington.
We need the FCC's help because we know that the mainstream media is owned pretty much by corporations. It's too bad, but we, like the citizens, don't have that power to go and the money to go all the time to Washington, D.C. to lobby. So we really depend on you, the FCC, to speak up for us. And, I mean, we'll do our best to do that, too, but we need your help.
Tracy Rosenberg of Media Alliance, a Bay Area media resource center, talked about how the story of the Jenna Six, the case of a half-dozen black teenagers facing unjust charges who brought 20,000 protesters to Louisiana in 2007, bubbled up from the community into the mainstream media.
Bubble up is such a merry-sounding term that I just wanted to kind of attach it to the reality of the hard work that people who really felt deeply impacted about that story and that it had to be told did 4 months to make that story bubble up. They didn't sleep. They gave up all their spare time. They lost wages. They lost jobs. If we're relying on that sort of monumental effort to resolve the failures of the legacy media and of, frankly, media consolidation, that's a pretty risky placard to hang ourselves on. It's a tremendous cost to the communities whose stories aren't being covered. And you know what? For every time that it does happen, there are 20 times that it doesn't happen. So bubbling up is great, but bubbling up is not a strategy to defend the public interest.
Outside the event, the Raging Grannies, grassroots activists who dress like little old ladies and sing protest songs, serenaded the workshop attendees. They were particularly concerned about the proposed merger between Comcast and NBC.
When a faceless corporation is our only source of news, and Big Brother at a distance can control what we can view, we're in trouble, and it threatens fairness and democracy. Corporations must not rule.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, May 30th, 2010, here in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois, on this lovely holiday weekend. Our guest today is someone I think well-known to many of our listeners. He is a distinguished professor of education at the University of Illinois Chicago, awarded the Citizen of the Year Award in Chicago in 1997 for his work on education policy and reform in the city of Chicago with the public schools, acclaimed by none other than Mayor Daley. Also known for the books he's written not only in education but on race and white supremacy, including the book he co-authored with Bernadine Dorn a couple of years ago, Race Course, and of course for his political activism in the 1960s and 70s, which he's chronicled in his own book, Fugitive Days. Bill Ayers, welcome to Media Matters.
Thanks very much, Bob. Nice to be here.
Hello, Bill.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Okay.
Hello?
It looks like we're working on our connection with Bill right now. In the meantime, let me tell you what we're up to here at WILL AM 580. We are going to be having our regular programming for the next couple of weeks. Next week, our guest is going to be... Hello, Bill.
Yeah, can you hear me?
I hear you now. Yes, thank you. It's great to have you.
I don't know what happened.
Yeah, I don't know either. I'm not going to even try to speculate what could have happened.
Okay.
You know, one of the main reasons we're having you on, Bill Ayers, is that you have a new, I don't know what they call these. They're graphic nonfiction, so they can't be graphic novels.
Well, this one is actually a novel. It's a fictionalized piece, but...
It is. Well, I read it. I thought you were telling the truth, Bill. I read the whole thing.
It chronicles, I'll tell you about it in a minute, but you can call it a graphic novel. You could call it a graphic memoir. We ourselves call it a comic book. So it's the first full-length comic book about teaching.
And this is based on a book you wrote some time ago, loosely. Is that correct?
Yes. I wrote a book 15 years ago called To Teach, The Journey of a Teacher, and it was a set of essays, somewhat personal essays, memoirs, stories, but it was a set of ideas about how to rethink teaching. And when we did a second edition, and then when they proposed to me, my publisher, that we do a third edition, the idea bored me to death, and I said rather flippantly, I'll do a third edition if we can do it as a comic. And I thought that would be the end of it, and they came back 2 months later and said, sure. So that is how this whole thing got generated.
You know, Bill, I know a little bit about your background, and I know about your work as a professor and a writer about education. I didn't realize you had done as much classroom work as an actual teacher. How much have you done in your life?
I was a classroom teacher for 12 years, and I've been a university professor for about 20 years. So,
And you were teaching what age kids?
I began teaching in...
Or children, I should say. I don't want to...
I began teaching in preschool, and I taught... in Head Start, I taught kindergarten, and I taught really every age group up through high school, and now I teach graduate school. So I've kind of done it all in teaching.
And, you know, you said you wanted to only do another edition if it could be a comic book, I guess, to make it more interesting, possibly more accessible, I assume. What was the process like of converting a book to comic book format?
Well, it's interesting. My motivation for suggesting a comic book was pure self-interest. I didn't want to do anything. And when they came back and said yes, I got intrigued. And that set us on a course of trying to find an artist that I could work with. And it took about 2 months, but I found this young man named Ryan Alexander Tanner, who's 25 years old. And he had been a student of my younger brother's at Berkeley High School. That's how I knew who he was. And he was a practicing commercial artist in Portland, Oregon. And so we began talking. He came out to Chicago. We wrote a book proposal. And when the proposal was accepted, he moved to Chicago, and he lived in our house for 6 months. Actually, it was the 6 months during the Obama campaign. And we worked every day on this thing. But what I learned, Bob, that was interesting, to me at least, was that I had initially thought he was going to illustrate my book. That was one misconception I had. The second misconception was I kind of thought that it would be a relatively simple process of taking the ideas that were already there and, as you say, kind of introducing them in a more accessible style. What I discovered in kind of a very quick tutorial with this artist is that, number one, we were going to have to write an entirely new book. It had to be a book with a plot, with characters, with a narrative arc, with challenges. And while we wanted to get the same ideas across, comic books are really a medium, not a genre. And so it wasn't like it was a simplifying of the book. In fact, this young man said to the publisher from day one, I only want to do it if we can make a book that's as complex, layered, nuanced, intellectually rigorous as the original. I don't want to do it if it's a softball, gateway drug into the real book. This will be a real book, and I think it is.
Yeah, in fact, that discussion you just gave us is presented early in the book as sort of as a conversation between you and the artist Ryan Alexander Tanner. And the sort of the argument that this is a distinct medium that has to be dealt with on its own terms, not as a lightweight medium.
Right. It would be like saying, let's go see a film Apocalypse Now, and that will be a gateway into reading about the Vietnam War. But that's not true. Apocalypse Now is its own medium. It's not a translation, and it's not a simplification. It's a complex presentation of the issues of the war in the medium of film. And so it was that kind of recognition that I had to come to. And the other thing I realized is that Ryan and I were going to have to figure out when the words were going to do the work and when the visuals were going to do the work. And we had to figure that out every day. And one example is the chapter we have on creating an environment. The last panel in that chapter is a single panel. It's a full page, but it's a single panel where Ryan represents some of the aspects of what makes a great learning environment. Well, I had written 5 pages of text, which he then, in his kind of genius and in his concision, made into a single panel. And at first I felt like weeping because I wanted every word in there, because I work with words. But the more I looked at it, the more I realized you could revisit that page time after time after time and get deeper and deeper meanings just as you can reading a text. And that really is the genius of comics today.
I'm looking at the page right now. As you mentioned that, I looked it up. And absolutely, that's really interesting background to know that you wrote 5 pages.
Yeah, and everything that I wrote is in there, but it's in there in very subtle ways, very emotional ways, very direct ways. And I think that's what comic books can do. That's what comic book art can do. That's what all art can do. But it's a kind of concision. It's like poetry in a sense that, somebody who works with words, the difficulty of writing a poem is exactly taking complex ideas and reducing them to a few lines. Well, in many ways, that's what Ryan did here. And he really is. I mean, he's a very brilliant young guy. And so we're excited about the book. In fact, we hope to come to Champaign in the fall and do a presentation about the book, either at the university or in a bookstore.
Well, keep us posted, and we'll certainly publicize the event Bill Ayers and let people know when you're in town.
That'd
and I'd like to meet Ryan when he's here.
Great.
Our guest, Bill Ayers, who we're talking to live on the phone here in WILL AM 580. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters. We're discussing his new book, his comic book, To Teach, The Journey in Comics, just out by Teachers College Press at Columbia University. It is available. It has a foreword by Jonathan Kozel. We're taking calls for people who like to call in and talk with Bill. Our number here at WILL is 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Bill Ayers, of course, distinguished professor at the University of Illinois Chicago, written widely on issues of teaching, of education, education policy, classroom pedagogy, white supremacy, and, of course, his history as an activist in the 1960s and 70s. It's a pleasure to have you on the show, Bill. I've been wanting to do it for a long time. Let's talk a little bit about the thing I really liked about the book as a teacher myself. Was, you know, really the sort of, I don't know for a better word, emotion of teaching. Because what comes across is really sort of what an emotional, passionate experience teaching is if it's going to be effective.
I think anyone who's done it and stuck with it will relate to both the emotional aspect of it, the ethical dimension of teaching, and how deeply intellectual teaching is. And this takes place in a kindergarten. It follows one teacher from his first day until the day of graduation of that kindergarten class. And yet you see that the layers of what's going on, the amount of thought that has to go into every gesture, the kind of ethical questions that get raised, and then you're right, the kind of emotional nature of it is foregrounded. And that's quite deliberate and quite intentional from the first edition of this book that I wrote, because I'm trying to counter what I think has taken on a kind of larger-than-life kind of truth to it that turns out to be completely false, and that is that teaching is like a clerk. To be a teacher is to be a clerk, is to pass along the information from higher up to lower down, and it's relatively easily learned and quickly remediated, and that's nothing like the experience I've had as a teacher. It bears no resemblance to what I know teaching to be. And I wanted to object, and I wanted to resist. And this book, in a kind of lighthearted and, I hope, humorous way, is an attempt to say there's an entirely different way to think about teaching than teaching as clerking.
Yeah, and one of the ways you describe it in the book I thought was extremely effective was you made the comparison, I forget who the acting coach was, Stanislavski or someone.
It was Stanislavski, yeah.
Yeah, to the sort of the comparison or the similarities between what a great actor does and what a great teacher does. Can you just talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I mean, the idea, for example, that an actor, all an actor has to do is memorize lines and then walk around a stage hitting his or her, you know, points and then delivering the lines. Everyone knows that's absurd. An actor develops a character, gets into the character, is able to communicate levels of emotion. Sometimes you see a movie like the movie that came out a year or two ago from Germany, The Lives of Others. The acting all takes place in the guy's eyes, and you're just moved and transformed by it, but not because of the words he's repeating like a parrot. And I make that comparison. I say teaching is like that. You can't just memorize how to write a lesson plan, how to stand up at a podium and deliver the goods. It's much more complex than that. It requires relationship building. It requires a sense of purpose. It requires an emotional investment. It requires an intellectual depth. I was thinking about this actually the other day. I went to see my 30-year-old son, who's a tenured middle school teacher in Oakland, California, in a tough school. And I spent 2 hours with him that morning, and he knew something about every kid who came in. He was like, how's your sister since the operation? Are you going to that event after school today? On and on and on. Plus, he knew things that where they each were in terms of mathematics. And as the morning drew to a close, I said to my brother who was with me, you know, everything that we look at and think is great in this young teacher, in Malik, is stuff that won't be able to be picked up on an evaluation form or a standardized test. And yet the relationships, the emotional investment, the thoughtfulness was all there and all very apparent. And that's what I'm trying to capture here.
Yeah. One of the things that, as I read the book, too, that occurred to me is, you know, you've taught kindergarten in the book and young kids, and that's what this book is primarily about as a memoir. But you've been a college professor now for many, many years, and you've taught both undergraduates and graduates at the University of Illinois at Chicago. And do these lessons apply at that level, or is that a whole different world?
No, it's the same world, almost exactly, almost precisely. And we chose to make it a kindergarten classroom, but we could have done it with anything. If you look, Bob, at the cover of the book, for example, that's a theme that applies to kindergarten, to preschool, to high school, and to college, and to graduate school. And the picture that you see there, the image, is the young teacher standing and a child sitting in a school desk. And the next panel is the child standing and the teacher squeezed into the kid's school desk. And the theme is that if you really want to be a great teacher, you have to listen to your students. You have to become a student of your students. You have to unlock the wisdom in the room. And in many ways, that is as true, it's certainly as true, teaching those kids as it is teaching graduate students.
Bill Ayer is our guest today. This is Media Matters. He's the author with Ryan Alexander Tanner of the new comic book / graphic novel To Teach the Journey in Comics, just out with Columbia University Press. If you'd like to call in with questions or comments for Bill Ayers, the number here is 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Bill Ayers is also the author of numerous other books in education. He's a distinguished professor at the University of Illinois, Chicago. He's written also widely on racism and white supremacy, including the book Race Course, which he co-authored with Bernardine Dorn a couple years ago. And he's written on his political activism in the 1960s in the book Fugitive Days, which came out roughly a decade ago. Let's go to the phone lines right now for our first caller. I think we've got Frina. You're on the air on line four. You're on with Bill Ayers.
What an honor. Thank you, Professor. Bill Ayers, I've admired you since your name was scandalized in the Obama campaign. I have two questions and a comment. Do you listen to this particular radio program?
No, I live in Chicago, so I don't actually get it.
I would ask you to go back in the archives and listen to every single program that this professor has done.
Well, I know his work, and I admire it tremendously. So
yes.
I'll try to do that.
Chomsky, Zinn, the stellar cast of American progressives have been on this show live, and I've talked to a bunch of them on this stupid little phone and listening on my stupid little clock radio. Okay, my comment is, I have a question. I can't remember Mr. Hayden's first name.
Tom.
Tom Hayden. Okay, he was on this program. I don't know, 6 months or a year ago, and I made this comment to him. I saw him on a I think it was a some kind of forum or something where he made the comment a couple of years ago that Gray Davis, the former governor of California, was recalled actually on a bogus premise, and it was in reality it was because he didn't follow his Democratic constituency. He actually basically betrayed his progressive and Democratic constituency by making a secret deal with PG&E when those criminals, the PG&E, became a criminal organization and at the same time burned California on the electric rates and put the state in this multi-billion-dollar debt. Okay, that's how Schwarzenegger got in.
Right.
And a lot of people don't realize this. Okay, Obama's making the same mistake. He is not listening to his progressive and liberal base. And I'd like you to comment on that. And thank you so much. And I love you. And I thank you so much for your activism in the 60s. I don't agree with that other branch of the Weathermen. I don't agree with violence in any way, shape, or form. But I love the fact that there were people out there in the 60s, and you were one of them, and your wife. And I saw you guys interviewed on Democracy Now! last 6 months. I don't know when it was, but thank you, and that's my comment.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Bill Ayers?
Thank you very much, and I also disagree with violence in all of its forms from wherever it comes from, so I think we probably agree. On the question of Obama, you know, I think one of the things that's interesting about the Obama presidency right now, and of course it's facing crisis after crisis, is that I want to go back to the campaign when Obama said over and over and over again, I'm a moderate, middle-of-the-road, pragmatic, compromising politician. He might have added the word ambitious. But he said that over and over, and the right wing kept saying, no, he's a secret socialist, he's a secret Muslim, he's a secret palling around with terrorist person, and we don't believe him. And the left made a kind of comparable mistake, which is they thought that he was winking at them. They thought that Obama was saying those things, but that really, because he was so intelligent, which he is, because he was a compassionate and decent guy, which I think he is, somehow he agreed with the left. But that's not true. And I think that it's important to note that when Obama was asked during the debates, who would Martin Luther King support, his response was, King wouldn't support any of us. He'd be in the streets building a movement for justice. So I want all of us, progressives, liberals, radicals, all of us, to remind ourselves that our job is not to look at the president or look at the king and wonder how he's going to do things and whether he's going to bring us peace or whether he's going to be good on GLBTQ issues. Our responsibility is to build a movement that's so strong and so irresistible that these things become our legacy. In other words, I don't look to the president to save us or to save some agenda that we might agree on. I look at us to not only create the agenda, but to build the kind of social movement that can make it become a reality. I think, for example, if you think back historically, Lyndon Johnson was never part of the Black Freedom Movement, and yet he passed the most far-reaching legislation, civil rights legislation, since Reconstruction. And Franklin Roosevelt was never part of the labor movement. And Lincoln was never part of an abolitionist party. It's our responsibility to get to the power that we have access to, which is the power in the neighborhood, in the community, in the school, in the workplace, and not to fawn so much in the face of the power that we also know exists, the Pentagon, the White House, the Congress, and Wall Street. We don't have access to that power, but we do have access to power of our own. And I feel like we're in a moment of tremendous movement building, tremendous movement making, and we ought to all get busy with that project.
Just to follow up on that point, Bill Ayers, do you think that were there a popular movement similar to the 1960s, the 1930s, the 1850s and 60s in the United States around popular progressive political issues, that a President Obama would respond favorably, that he is pliable, he is not someone who would be, just at that level, if there were such a movement, he would be able to do what those other presidents had done?
Well, I think a movement generates a force that becomes, yes, irresistible. And I think that even a Nixon or a Bush would respond to a real social movement on the ground. And it's our job right now to build that movement. I look at things, for example, in the run-up to this show, Bob, you talked about some Media Matters conference in Detroit. I hope everybody's thinking about going to the U.S. Social Forum June 22nd to 26th. There's a place where grassroots organizers will be coming together, learning from one another in a horizontal fashion, and I think energizing ourselves for the work ahead. But part of what it means to me to do movement building, and I can return to education with this, part of what it means is changing the framework, and this is something, Bob, that I think your work is involved with an awful lot, and that is not accepting the terms of the debates that are given to us, but demanding a new way of seeing things and articulating a new vision, another possibility. And I think in education it's so clear to me that the debate has narrowed to a neoliberal agenda that's so bankrupt and so corrupt. And it's our job as educators, those of us who are educators and progressives, to change that frame dramatically and to begin the debate over on a whole different ground. So that's part of what I think our job is, yes. And I think, yes, that the Obama administration would respond to a real social movement on the ground.
in the optimism you just expressed, and I do think there's definitely a measure of optimism, is also in the book, and it is a refreshing change. And I urge listeners who are looking for something that sort of is forward-thinking, this book is part of that. Our guest, Bill Ayres, author of To Teach, The Journey in Comics, the artist Ryan Alexander Tanner, the co-author. This is Media Matters on WILLA and 580. If you want to call in with a question or comment for Bill Ayres, the number 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. And, you know, as I read the book, Bill, there were a couple of issues, one you just raised that I want to get back to in a second, but another one, too, which is that, you know, it struck me, and I might be wrong here because I'm not an education professor or historian or scholar, but it's always struck me that the sort of very liberal, humane education, and liberal in the small L, liberal sense, progressive education that you advocate in the book and relationship between teacher and student and engagement, which is something that really creates, you know, citizens who are empowered and lead full lives, that while at a certain rhetorical level, our society is all for that in some vague sense, that, you know, does our society really want poor people to have that sort of command over their lives? Or, I mean, does they really want an educational system that does that? Or is that, or realistically, are we, the truth is that we much prefer an educational system that, like a Dickens style, that trains basically poor people to stay in their place and do what they're supposed to do.
Well, the shocking thing is we really do have a Dickensian kind of educational system. And even though Dickens wrote Hard Times over 150 years ago, the classroom he describes is remarkably familiar to anyone who set foot in an American school. The struggle or the contest that goes on, Bob, I think, is between the Dickensian kind of reality and a vision that people would also like to hold on to. In other words, I think people are conflicted. On the one hand, education as job training, education as finding your place on the hierarchy of winners and losers, is very much the practice of American schools. But on the other hand, if you ask people, and I mean people of all backgrounds and classes and races and regions, what do you hope for your children? What do you think education ought to be? You can pretty quickly come to agreement that education is about opening doors, opening minds, creating opportunities. It's about not just training to get a job, but it's about inducting people into the fullness of the culture, including the possibility of doing great things and including the necessity of being citizens who are the sovereign, who run the country. That means the work you do, for example, where the restriction of information and the restriction of the constraining of the imagination. That's very much what those of us who are in schools and imagine and work for a more humane future, very much where we do our struggling. You look at things like the Texas history standards or the Florida history standards, and you absolutely flip out at the fact that they're legislating the end of thought. They're not just saying, let's have this standard and not that standard. In Florida, they passed a bill that said history shall not be taught as an interpretation or a process. History shall be taught as facts and dates. Well, my God, that is the end of thought. And so this is the arena of our struggle. It's not, when I describe that, I'm not saying that in a despairing way at all. I'm saying that describes the reality before us, and that gives us a sense of where we have to engage the battle.
In one of the areas that the issue is, you know, that I think in the No Child Left Behind, the George W. Bush plan for education, I think embodied in some ways exactly what you said, because at a superficial level, it was all about giving poor kids and disadvantaged children an opportunity to get the education that middle class and upper middle class kids, rhetorically, that was it about. But then the actual policies within it that I think you indirectly criticize in the book, or they're related to it, the standards obsession, for example, and testing, were very much in a different mind. And I guess that's a long way of getting to my question, which is that in the book, an implicit issue in the book is how you as a teacher during the course of the story are being hassled by these so-called education experts to sort of teach this sort of standard-driven, test-driven, rote-driven style, and how you resist it. And where does that battle stand today in America?
Well, I think the battle is very much going on, community by community, classroom by classroom, city by city. But I think that we're in very deep trouble in terms of the national conversation. I can give you one example of an expression of that. You know, the kind of hammering of teachers, which is a regular feature of the news, the kind of sense that it's always the teachers who are a problem. So Newsweek has a cover story, picture of a chalkboard, and on it is written over and over and again, fire the bad teachers, fire the bad teachers. The New Yorker does a story on the rubber room, which is this odd holding pen where people, teachers who have been removed from their classrooms, but their cases have not been adjudicated, wait for their hearings. And the story focuses on 15 teachers in a system of 40,000. And it acts as if that's the whole problem, is bad teachers. So this is that question of framing. When John McCain would get to a microphone and say, we need to get the lazy, incompetent teachers out of the classroom, everyone in America nodded dully. I think even I nodded. What am I going to do? Stand up and say my granddaughter deserves the lazy teacher? Of course not. He framed the issue, so he gets the right answer. I would frame the issue differently if I had gotten to the microphone first. I might have said, every kid in a public school deserves an intellectually competent, morally grounded, compassionate, caring, well-rested, and well-paid teacher in the classroom. I would get nods of agreement as well. So the question is, who's doing the framing? The New Yorker ran a puff piece on Secretary of Education Arne Duncan a few months ago, and in it the author said this: there are really only two positions in the school reform debates. One is the free market reformers, the people who want to test, they want to test and punish, they want to ratchet up the standards, they want to get rid of teachers, they want to privatize. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, he said, we have the liberal traditionalists who think that everything is fine, the unions are great, and the teachers' colleges are wonderful. Now, the problem with that frame is, well, first of all, I don't know anyone who fits that second category. And even the author himself interviewed lots and lots of people who don't fit his, you know, his convenient dyad there. But the more important thing is that in the course of the article, he points out that Arne Duncan himself went to the University of Chicago lab school for 12 years. The Obama kids went to the lab school. And in fact, my kids also, when we came to Chicago, went to the lab school. And what did they find in the lab school? They found small classes, capped at 15. They found well-resourced classrooms. They found a curriculum based, at least in part, on curiosity and following your own interests. And they found a teacher corps that was not only respected, but was unionized. And so all the shouting about what we need, bigger standards tied to bigger punishments, firing the teachers, a single test, all of these things are a dodge from exactly what the Obama kids had, which is the features I just mentioned. So John Dewey at one point said, you know, what we need as a community for all of our children is what the most privileged and wisest parents have for theirs. In other words, the standard is, what do the privileged have? And in a democracy, at least theoretically, you would say, that's what we're trying to achieve. And if we had that discussion, if the president were to say, my kids, Malia and Sasha, are getting a great education over here at Sidwell Friends, and that's the standard I'm trying to reach all across the country, we would be in a different discussion. Those of us who care about the future of this country, of education, of the possibility of democracy, have to raise that standard and fight that, I think, very narrow dualism with that.
Our guest, Bill Ayers, you've just been listening to. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters. Bill Ayers is the co-author with Ryan Alexander Tanner of the new graphic novel comic book To Teach, the Journey in Comics, just out with Columbia University Press. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment to WILL AM 580, the number here is 333-9455, our toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Let's go to line one. Champagne, you're on the air.
Hi. Actually, after that discourse that you did a great job. It pretty much eliminated a lot of my questions in terms of comments. I guess the way I view it is that, gee, wouldn't it be something if every child in the United States had a quality education rather than spending $50,000 per individual that's in jail when they think nothing of that? A small investment early would certainly have a great impact there. You can make a comment on that. Or the last one is that, I don't know if you saw the documentary on College Inc. Do you happen to see that one or not?
If not, no.
It was about this whole privatization of, you know, colleges. There's a whole group. You know, we have private colleges, but these are corporations, you know. What's that one out in Arizona University?
Yeah, it's called,
Phoenix.
University of Phoenix.
That's the whole model. And what's happened is these people are being shortchanged, and it's certainly it's the lower income, you know, can't get in this place or that place, and taken advantage of, and they get the loans, you know, through the government, and there's a whole big thing going on there. And it's a very, very sad commentary, I don't know whether on kind of this privatization thing. You know, what happens to the common good? So anyway, any comments there? Great program.
Well, thank you very much, caller. And Bill, while you're answering that, I think that opens a large can of worms of one I want to get your feedback on, which is the whole notion of commercialism in education. As public schools in particular are desperate for funds in economic downturn, and there's no longer funds, as they increasingly turn to commercial sources of revenues, be it advertising or sponsorship of one form or another, what does that do to the type of, frankly, sacred learning environment that you write about in this book?
Yeah, I think that these are linked, the point you raise and the question, in the sense that, you know, we have to situate the attack on public education. I mean, first of all, there's always been an argument about whether the public schools and how much to invest in the public schools. But the fight 30 years ago was a fight about who is the public in public education. And so the fight was for inclusion. The fight was around ending segregation and so on. But for the last 30 years, it's been a different fight altogether, and I think people have been slow to realize it. And that is the question of should there be a public system has really been fueling the whole kind of right-wing attack. And this comes straight out of Reaganism. I mean, the distrust of the public, the distrust of the public square, the elimination of the commons, the eclipse of the public, we've seen it in every sphere, in every aspect of our lives. And now we see it viciously in public education. It's been growing for 30 years, but now it's coming at us in a massive and a very vicious way. And I think we can't accept it. I think we have to say that in order to thrive as a society, we not only need the public system, but we need a transformed public system, not a public system based on a 19th century model of what, you know, what will work educationally, but a public educational system that is really forward-looking and sees the challenges and the needs of the 21st century in a very different way. So I'm not for saving the existing system. I'm for transforming it and using this moment of crisis to transform it. But I think that the caller makes a hugely important point, and that is that our investment in prisons, our investment in surveillance, our investment in sorting and punishing, all of these things are bankrupting our society, not just financially, but morally, ethically. And when we say to each other, when we look around and say, gosh, the economic downturn and we've got all this hardship, we have to link the issues. That's another part, it seems to me, of building a movement. And we have to see the ways in which a $1 trillion military budget and a multi-billion dollar prison industrial complex, those things are bankrupting us. And why is that sacred money over there when we're going to lay off 300,000 teachers in the next year if we don't have some emergency input from the federal government? I think we have to link the issues, and we have to say education first, health care first, guaranteed levels of income first, and war and surveillance and incarceration, all of that way, way down the line.
And real quick, Bill, just on the issue of commercialism and profit-making schools, where does that fit into your vision?
You know, it's part of the same problem, and that is that it narrows our sense of what's possible and what exists. And so the commercialization of schools, the idea that people have to beg Coca-Cola or Exxon for funds, and then they'll have the School for Energy and Oil. I mean, it's insane. They're selling off the public space, as we are in so many other arenas of life. But when we sell off education, we sell off our future in a very direct and powerful and palpable way. And frankly, I think people understand this. I think people can come to understand it. That's why I say, oh, and by the way, I don't consider myself an optimist or a pessimist, but I do feel like I have a lot of confidence that if we frame the issues properly, if we name the problems appropriately, we can win over lots of people. And that's why I think part of our job as progressives, as radicals, is always to talk to strangers, always to be out there in the world discussing these issues and trying to change the frame.
Let's go back to the phone lines now. Our guest again, Bill Ayres, professor of education at the University of Illinois at Chicago, author, co-author of the new graphic novel To Teach, The Journey in Comics. Let's go now to line two, Champaign County. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, on that documentary about the private schools, one of the things that stuck out at me was that they spend more money on promotion and advertising than they do on actual education. It's probably tax deductible.
It's like the food industry or something. It's insane. Exactly.
They probably also have these huge salaries comparable to what one of the much Ballyhoo charter schools in Harlem is paying $500,000 a year, approaching the president of the University of Illinois salary, actually.
Right.
Astonishingly absurd in my point of view. But Arne Duncan, his mother was a teacher, and that's his only credential, apparently, and he went to school, I guess. As you said, that's a pretty good school, but he's the turnaround artist. He's the venture capitalist trying to put the corporate model on schools and taking some language from the small schools movement, it seems to me, here and there. But it's really a scam, and I think that if you really look at the damage that's been done to the communities, I've heard and been persuaded that the disruption of the school districts and the way they move people around and militarize schools. There's now 7 military academies, and that's all since Arne Duncan has hit Chicago school system.
Just on that, real quickly, I think that you're absolutely right, and I think that Arne Duncan is going to be exposed the same way Rod Paige was exposed when he came to Washington as the Secretary of Education from Houston, touting the Texas Miracle. And the Texas Miracle turned out to be a fraud. I don't think any of the people who were candidates for Secretary of Education, Joel Klein, Michelle Rhee, Paul Vallis, or Arne Duncan, none of them had a record that they should be proud of. And all of them have a bigger public relations firm than they have an accomplishment.
Right. Well, I think the deaths of some of the people that have been killed in violence, of course, it's a violent society, period. And I don't know that military academies are helping that in any way, but the disruption is highly visible. Gang fights, part of that's disrupting the community, and you can't blame it all on this school reform movement. The other parting note, if I can, is that it's, I don't know if you've mentioned that the election has gone to a runoff in the Chicago unions, and that there is a reform group that just totally debunks the Duncan model and wants to fight it. But with this race to the top money, giving 180 points for ending teacher tenure and all these other features that come right out of a Reagan-esque playbook, the horse might already be out of the barn. Anyway, enough of the metaphors. Thanks a lot. I'll listen.
Well, I think you're absolutely right, and I appreciate your points. I mean, I think that the race to the top, Arne Duncan himself said that No Child Left Behind is a toxic brand, and so he rebranded it as the race to the top. But what could be more absurd for anybody who knows about education than the idea that we would frame it as a metaphorical race, that is, winners and losers, and we're coercing people. This is the biggest, kind of federal intervention in schools, and what is it? It's a race so that there will be some winners and many, many losers. That's not the spirit of education at all. The wonderful thing about education is it's a bit like love. You can give all your learning away and not lose a thing. And yet that's not the way they're talking about it. They're using the metaphor of the market. That is, education is a product, much like a refrigerator or a stove. It can be bought and sold at the marketplace. Nothing about education as a human right or education is a journey that doesn't just exist to train you for a job, but actually is something that begins at birth and never ends. These are some of the problems. The other point that the caller made that is so critical is the militarization of our schools, Bob, like the commercialization of our schools, is tearing the guts out of what education is supposed to be. And so in Chicago, there's a pretty robust movement to kick the military out of the schools. The schools are no place for the recruitment of soldiers and for practicing marching with guns. We had over 30 gun deaths in Chicago this school year. And the idea that, deaths of kids by kids, and the idea that we would have kids marching in school with guns is an obscenity. So we have a lot of work to do, but I'm confident that that there is a pushback, that there is a contestation going on, that it's not a settled matter, but it's a matter in process, and that's why people should join the fight.
Our guest, Bill Ayers, author of the new book, or co-author of the new book, To Teach, The Journey in Comics. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters. Let's take one last caller now. Line 4, Coles County, you're on the air.
Yes, I agree that there's too much emphasis on testing. However, since we do have enormous emphasis on testing, I wanted to make an important point, and that is that at the federal level and also at the Illinois state level, there is really no mandatory testing on the social sciences, and specifically none on history. It seems to me that progressives ought to be pushing for some kind of testing, if there's going to be testing, that it include history and the social sciences, especially with the tremendous ignorance that we have today, of course, by people in those particular areas. So what is your comment on that?
Well, I have a couple of comments. One is you're absolutely right to point out that teachers aren't stupid, and if you test on reading and math, that's all that's going to be taught. Nobody's teaching the arts. Nobody's teaching physical education. Nobody's going to teach history or geography. And you almost feel like, gosh, are we mandating ignorance, backwardness? For example, you probably know this, but National Geographic did a survey of 18 to 25-year-old American kids, gave them a blank world map. 80% couldn't find Iraq. 80% couldn't find Palestine, Israel. 40% couldn't find Great Britain. And an astonishing 10% couldn't find the United States. Now, that's willful ignorance. That's kind of learned ignorance, because we don't teach these things. And the problem with just going along with the testing regime, I mean, I understand the point, and I think it's got interesting merit, but the problem is that we end up in a situation, and I want to point out that this only applies to poor kids, to kids to African-American kids or immigrant kids. But the New York Times, just to give one example, had a front-page story about 4 months ago, and it was a little African-American girl looking over a pig pen to a group of pigs playing in a farmyard. And the headline was, "Trip to the Farm May Increase Test Scores." And I wanted to jump out of a window. I mean, there's not one middle-class person in Hyde Park or the suburbs of Chicago who said, "I won't introduce my kids to music or to theater or to the farm or to a trip to the beach unless it helps their test scores." It's only other people's children who that kind of nonsense gets laid on. And so I think we have to fight for a robust education worthy of citizens. We have to make the argument that the full development of each individual is a necessary component of the full development of all. And the reverse is also true. The fullest development of all of us is the condition for the full development of any of us. And we need to make that point again and again. And I think it's a point we can win.
Let's go back. We do have time for one more caller, and we have someone waiting patiently on line 1. Bloomington, you're on the air with Bill Ayers. I think you're there. Are you still there, Bloomington? I guess we lost Bloomington after all. Sorry about that. Bill, you know, we've only got a few minutes left, and one issue I really wanted to spend more time on, but the callers took us in a different direction, is the book you wrote on race with Bernadine Dorn and the issue of white supremacy, because as I read the book To Teach, the graphic novel, race was certainly a subplot throughout the book in your teaching experience. And, you know, for for most Americans, say white Americans live in predominantly white communities, I mean, what would be the lessons you would say from your experiences on race, if you had a few minutes to communicate them, you'd want to communicate?
The important thing, it seems to me, that we need to understand about race in this country is that white supremacy, a system and an assumption of white power and white authority, has been consistent through the whole founding and development of our country. It's survived intact, even though it's changed its form. It survived a Revolutionary War. It survived a Civil War. It survived the Civil Rights Movement. And now it's survived the election of an African-American president. So it's a very tenacious devil in a certain way. But it doesn't serve our interests in the long run. In the long run, we have to embrace what James Baldwin said 40 years ago, which was, America's not white anymore, and it will never be white again. And so the kind of anxiety that comes with recognizing ourselves as a nation, for one thing, as the United States, as a nation among nations, rather than the uber-nation, and recognizing ourselves, those of us who are white and have European ancestry, recognizing that we are just one of many, that we are not the uber race or the superior race, it coming to terms with that takes some effort, but it's essential if we're going to live a harmonious, balanced, and peaceful future. And I think that's what most of us really, really want. And I think we have to engage in conversations, for example, with the Tea Party people, and make the make the argument.
Do you I mean, in the course of your life, Bill, your adult life, certainly, say, going back 40-some years, what sort of changes have you seen in matters of race in the United States? So what have been the big changes?
Well, I think there have been enormous changes in the sense that, that apartheid in the South was done away with. The problem is that apartheid, unofficial apartheid, all throughout the country has not been done away with. And so if you think of the meaning of the Civil Rights Movement, it was initially a fight for racial justice. Martin Luther King moved it toward a fight for economic justice and global justice, none of which have been achieved. And even the tactics of the Civil Rights Movement, the tactics of integrating the schools, the tactic of voting rights, those things have been undone in the last couple of decades. And so we have segregated schools in Chicago. We have disenfranchisement throughout the South and throughout the country. And these are things that are basic to democracy. They're not kind of peripheral. So I would say we've done a couple steps forward and a couple steps back. We have a lot more to do to be wise and thoughtful and understanding. Here's an example, the death penalty or incarceration. The incarceration rates are, African Americans are overrepresented in juvenile justice. They're overrepresented in prisons. They're overrepresented on death row. These are not kind of by chance. These are things that actually are reflections of an unjust history, and one that we should understand much better than we do if we're going to combat it into the future.
Our guest today has been Bill Ayers. This is Media Matters. I hear the band tuning up in the background, Bill, which means they want to clear me out of the studio.
Very good.
I want to thank you so much for taking time out of your holiday weekend to join us here on WILL. Good luck with your book, To Teach the Journey in Comics.
Thank you, Bob. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks so much.
I'm Bob McChesney. I want to thank Kyle Kroha for working the boards this weekend. Melissa Trentz, my producer, for doing her wonderful work. I'll be back 1 week from today, 167 hours, with Alex Gibney talking about his new film on Casino Jack and the United States of Money. Until then, everyone have a wonderful holiday weekend. Bye-bye.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
In the weather forecast for Champaign-Urbana, we'll see increasing clouds today, and there's a 30% chance of showers and thunderstorms this afternoon with a high of 82 degrees. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3 Urbana.